On this week's 51%, meet a woman who has ideas about how to help schools help their young students resolve racial conflict.
And it's very important to teach our kids empathy in dealing with other people and in dealing with pain.
And hear how a nonprofit is supporting new moms. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Violence in the U.S. of people of different colors, cultures, religions, and political groups has reached new levels, and it's affecting our youth. Social media may have worsened the divisive rhetoric and fanned the flames of hatred even more in recent years, but how can we come to racial reconciliation, especially with our youth? Jesmaine Bohempol has some ideas. She's the author of My Blood Divides and Unites, and uses the power of story to reconcile racial contradictions. Bohempol, who is based in Johannesburg, South Africa, provides ways we can help our youth and schools deal with racial conflicts. Bohempol is the former head of business engagement at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. She has served on the boards of various international organizations and holds a master's degree from Harvard University's JFK School of Government. She was honored as a young global leader of the World Economic Forum, is a Harvard Mason Fellow, and a shareholder and founding board member of African Women Chartered Accountants Investment Holdings. She has worked on three continents and traveled to more than 65 countries.
The book talks of my coming of age in apartheid. As I was 21 years old when apartheid ended. And as you know, there were a lot of segregation between different groups of people. What you may not know is that people of color were also separated from each other. So there were three categories: blacks, Indians, and then coloreds, which are historically mixed, people of historically mixed race descent. I'm from the colored racial group. And before we go on, I do know that in America, the word colored is derogatory, and I'm sensitive about that. But please keep in mind that in South Africa, colored is a official racial category. And under apartheid, we were separated by law, went to separate schools, lived in separate neighborhoods, and this is basically our Jim Crow. And against this background, I wrote the book for three reasons. I wanted to inspire people coming from similar marginalized communities. I was raised in a neighborhood called Westbury, an area known for a lot of crime. And then the story of colored people of South Africa is quite peculiar, and it's not well known. And people really get confused when I try and explain it when I'm outside South Africa. And I wanted to share the story with the international community. And then using my story, I also wanted to bring in a message that's relevant today's world. And right now, societies and nations are so divided and fractured. And I wanted a message of reconciliation that would speak to this.
Now, you've traveled around the world. When you look at racial conflict in the U.S., how does it compare with, and it's so general, I know it will depend upon the country and region within a country, so I appreciate how generalized the question is, but perhaps you could highlight some basic differences between racial conflict in the U.S. and elsewhere.
So let's compare to South Africa. I'll start with, in my book, My Blood Divides and Unites, I've interviewed people from around the world, including Americans of different backgrounds. And I interviewed a classmate of mine from Harvard. She's also a black woman. And she lived in South Africa for about 10 years. Her name is Susan Ellen Reed. She's moved back to the States recently. And in her mind, in South Africa, race issues are more acknowledged, whereas in America, it's more swept under the carpet. So in South Africa, I think it's common even in the media for someone to say, this person did that because they have a racial view. Sometimes it can be used as an easy way of framing issues around race when the issue might be involve multiple themes, but it's just calling each other on race in a public forum. Politicians do that all the time. And whereas I think in America, the people feel that the issue was swept under the carpet and that there's a discomfort on talking about it. Also, in South Africa, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which took place soon when apartheid ended in 1994. And that was done to bring together perpetrators of crime linked to apartheid with the victims and bring them together in the same forum. And in some case, it involved an element of restorative justice. I do call in my book for a second Truth and Reconciliation Commission with a purpose that could bring in a wider spectrum of society and that can look at building racial reconciliation on a sustainable future basis. But at least South Africa had that first process of truth and reconciliation, which America hasn't had. But having said that, there are some similarities in racial issues, and some similarities where there can be sometimes be subtext to a conversation. It's not obvious that some people could feel discriminated against, and then there could be a racial bias in that discrimination. It's difficult to call out as obvious. In South Africa, black South Africans are in the majority of the population, which is different to in America. A lot of the racial issues are with minority groups. So the voting power and the lobbying power could be felt less strongly in America than in the States.
We will get to racial conflict in schools and how you recommend that's handled. But first, can you divide racial conflict by gender?
So I know in America you'd have black men more vulnerable to incarceration. In South Africa, there was different roles during apartheid that men and women played. So women tend to be domestic workers, where they'd work in the home of a white person, or factory workers in textile. Men tended to do the more manual labor, working on the mines, and a lot of the roles for men tended to be migrant labor, where if there were years ago, the laws prohibited men from bringing their families with them to the mine. So that created a separation of men from their families. So the impact that was felt was slightly different. Today, I think South Africa does try to empower women and men. I'd have to think about whether for myself or anyone as a woman, is there more discrimination by being black and a woman?
You know, given what's going on with immigration in this country, which to me is racial conflict, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with racial conflict with this interplay of immigration?
Now, I think that you need, because they are practical elements to a country securing its borders. At the same time, there is the human component and how implementation is done and what is fair. And I think it can be dangerous if you have someone making these very sensitive decisions who has a racial bias to start off with.
You know, it seems if we had a border with Switzerland, the situation immigration-wise under this president would be a bit different. You know?
No, you're making a very good point. You're making a very good point.
Okay, let's talk about your book and schools handling racial conflict and how this should be addressed.
There are different ways to talk to our kids about race. The most important one is on empathy. We find a lot of knee-jerk reactions when there's racial conflict. It can become so emotional and sensitive. And it's very important to teach our kids empathy in dealing with other people and in dealing with pain. and having empathy for different views, different opinions, trying to walk in someone else's shoes and connecting to their feelings. I feel in a lot of race, it's, you know, there's defensive reactions as opposed to really taking that few minutes to really see it from the other person's perspective. And I quote from my book, I state, that's because empathy, listening to the other person with an open heart and connecting with the other person's feelings, even if you don't agree, can put you in the other person's shoes, and that can often be a catalyst for repairing and strengthening broken, even hostile relationships. And I think the empathy brings about the understanding as we seek to relate to each other.
Yeah, but what do you do when parents or guardians are teaching one aspect and teachers completely different one?
I think then you just need to hope that love prevails over messages of hatred. But I think at least then if the school is giving that positive message and that's instilled across schools, at least it can act as a counter against if there's a negative message coming from the parent. So I think it would be worse if the school is silent or if they reinforcing a negative message from a parent.
Now, you also talk about in your book, Bridging for Authentic Connection. What does that mean?
With Bridging for Authentic Connection, it was seeking the understanding with someone else and having an authentic desire to connect with another person. And I used the book in South Africa. It happened infrequently where white South Africans would say to me, you know, we didn't have anything to do with apartheid. And if someone says so, I perceive that person's trying to defend their legacy or their family. They're not really trying to connect with me and my circumstance. And in contrast, there's other white South Africans who said to me, and just people I didn't know, it just come up to me and say, you know, I know it must have been so hard, the experiences that you had gone through. And immediately I'd feel a connection to that person. I feel like that person is trying to authentically connect to me. And it's a lens through which people can try and look at conversations with people from another racial group, as opposed to a defensive lens, so trying to defend positions or trying to defend that someone is not racist.
Now, you also talk about schools setting aside funds to address racial conflict. Now, I'm in New York, so school funding is a bit on the tight side, but in a perfect world, perhaps, and it's certainly an interesting idea. Now, from where did you devise it? Please talk more about this idea that schools should set aside funds for students to receive counseling from past racial incidences, which have caused trauma and hinder effective race relations going forward.
So I haven't seen it in action, but I feel that there's a lot of trauma that comes from racial acts. And when we look at trauma of war veterans, there is trauma that groups have been oppressed or individuals have oppressed or felt. And if you don't deal with that trauma, you can't move forward your buttons will always be pushed. And most of the book, we're coming to apartheid, you just had to get by and then go to university and qualify. Even the book provided just an opportunity of me for reflection and for healing. And I feel that if you have those counseling spaces where people can acknowledge hurts and pain and anger from racial incidences that happened in the past, it can make someone more resilient going forward, so that new interactions, it's not always about hitting a trauma button.
What about how you grew up? How did that shape you?
It's really given, because it came from a poor family and a marginalized community, and I'm a first-generation professional, and so I know what a long and hard road it is to break that generational cycle of poverty, and I have such a heart for people from similar communities and for people generally from emerging markets, because I know it's so hard when you start a career and you weren't having these business discussions at the dinner table when you were growing up, so you've got so much more catching up to do. And at the same time, there's a magnifying glass on you on can you do it. So there's a lot of pressure, a lot of catching up, and I have that heart for people who have similar backgrounds.
Something tells me you serve as a mentor, and I mean, you're so successful in so many ways and could really serve as a model for informing young women and girls. And maybe you could talk about how you do this.
Well, yes, on the mentoring, and that's, I try and with some individuals have, you know, one-on-one interactions on where they are in their career, what are their plans to get to the next step, how do they have some conversations in the workplace in a way that's assertive, but at the same time not hostile. And then I'm also hoping more broadly through the message of this book that it can be an inspiration for people who have those backgrounds. I'm part of the African Women Investment Company. We 60 African women shareholders in an investment vehicle. And when we invest in companies, it's also to bring through the message on boards on how do we get more women into the company. We have an HR company that does recruiting as well of women professionals, and making the companies we invest in aware of what they can be doing to bring women up the ranks, to broaden the female clientele. A lot of people would be saying, where are the black people, senior executives, where are the women? And they'll say, oh, we can't find them. And then we've got an HR company, there's 2,000 people on our database. They're there. That takes away any argument.
Any other points you want to make from perhaps the book or life lessons?
Yeah, so going back to the message for kids, it's in my book, it's about telling my story, and then I bring in stories from around the people from around the world in dealing with race, and there's so much power in our stories. And I feel that schools can create small groups of students, ideally from different cultural backgrounds, to share personal stories of their journey, their identity, where they've made choices, what are their lingering emotions now. And those small groups, this sort of encourages the individual kids to connect to each other's stories, and it encourages kids to feel power in their story. Sometimes they haven't verbalized it. And that's, I think, a good way for kids, for schools to start embedding a culture of embracing different people from different backgrounds. And I think if you do that, everyone's story has power. The person who comes from Harlem, the person who comes from, you know, a middle class family, you're putting value on everyone's story, and everyone can try and understand the other person.
And what age group are you talking about in school here?
So this is on the how kids should deal with how you deal with race with kids. I would say from elementary school, because kids already start having, it could be subconscious biases, it could be biases they pick up at home. They might say something that could be perceived as, racially discriminatory, and they're not even aware. So I'd say from 7 years old to adolescence.
What about social media? How does this help or hinder racial conflict?
Now that's a very good point, and it's something that I do think about, that social media it's not helping the echo chamber and the rhetoric around certain ideas. And what I think, you know, I call upon parents and schools to encourage debate and encourage an awareness of alternative views, so that kids can, you know, not be caught up in that bubble or that echo chamber. Ideally, you'd want to encourage the social media companies to change their algorithms so that they're not just feeding people one stream of messaging depending on their searches. I don't know if that's too ambitious.
But it's all about what we're talking about, the algorithms and social media. It's all about economics at some point, isn't it? I mean, who they're reaching, who they want to reach. And unless someone says something or money starts talking, what's the impetus for change?
Now, I like what you're saying that maybe they should be lobby groups that lobby the social media companies on that, because I wouldn't expect... there could be some bias in the algorithm, but at least add 20 to 30% random component of what is being fed to an individual. I think that they should just do that as part of their social responsibility.
That was Jasmine Bohempol. Her debut book is My Blood Divides and Unites. Lori Lightfoot's victory in the Chicago mayoral race signaled hope among voters that the nation's third largest city may someday move beyond long entrenched divides, racial and otherwise, that have left large parts of the metropolis feeling ignored by people in power. Lightfoot became the city's first black female and first openly gay mayor when she defeated another black woman, Cook County Board President Toni Preckwinkle, in the April 2nd election. Lightfoot joined Chicago's top prosecutor and police chief as black leaders in a city that continues to struggle with race relations. Across much of the Midwest, maternal and infant death rates are high, especially among African Americans. So doctors, public health agencies, and nonprofit organizations are searching for solutions. Among them is Sistering CU in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. It offers free home visits from trained volunteers to families with babies up to 6 months in age. It also recently launched a support group for new parents. Co-founder Erin Murphy spoke with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman about a new initiative to promote safe sleep habits and support families.
We target families who have just had a baby, whether that's through adoption or, you know, delivered the baby themselves. So our programs focus on sending a volunteer, matching a volunteer to go to their home for 2 hours a week for 12 visits to help them as they recover and transition to becoming a mom and becoming a dad and getting used to having a family life. And it takes help to do that, we believe so.
Yeah. You guys have a new grant-funded effort that you are doing right now involving baby boxes. So can you tell me a little bit about what baby boxes are and what purpose they serve?
Yes. So baby boxes are an idea that was developed first in Finland and like in the 1930s. And every single family in Finland gets a baby box. And the box, first of all, serves a double purpose. It holds like diapers, bottles, things that you might need for bringing home a new baby. But the box itself is also a safe place for the baby to sleep.
So like a bassinet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can move it from room to room because it's a box. It's a cardboard box. But inside there is a mattress and some sheets. So it's a comfortable, lightweight, safe place for the baby to go from room to room or to sleep next, you know, like on the floor next to you. And it's shown to reduce rates of SIDS for families that don't have a place that's safe for baby to sleep.
And I learned that even in Virginia, they give these boxes to all new families across the state.
In Virginia, everyone in that whole state will be getting a baby box. And there are some other states like that. New Jersey also, I think, does it. And Louisiana had a program as well. And it has shown in those states to reduce rates of SIDS when they went out.
Yeah, that sudden infant death syndrome.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when we heard about this idea, we were so inspired because it's like both a practical, useful tool for the family and also a symbol of support. Like what you're doing is really important. What it really matters, it's good for the community, for you to be healthy, for your family to be healthy. And so we're just thrilled to be able to start the program. At least, you know, 50 boxes is a small start, but it's a start.
And you also recently started a new parent support group.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes. So we bring one of our volunteers in, and we have a little space for the babies to kind of lay down on the ground, some toys there. So they're right in the room with us. And we just talk about the highs, the lows,
And the in-betweens.
And the in-between, yeah. You know, like, and share tips, like what worked for you for sleeping, what didn't work for you. My baby doesn't sleep. And the truth is some babies just don't sleep. And that's okay, and we can talk about it. And it doesn't mean you're a bad mom or dad that you can't get your baby to take two-hour naps.
Is there anything else you would like to share?
We are recruiting families. I think one of the hardest things is to know that it's normal to need help and to want help at the beginning, and we don't have to do it all on our own. So we're trying to really change the expectations that we can do this, we should do this. In fact, it takes a village, and we have lost our villages around us when we live in a transient community. We're far away from grandparents or our close friends and neighbors who would have helped us. And we want to be that village. We just want to be there and support you because we do believe what you're doing is really important. We believe you're important. So we just want to be there to support you.
That's Erin Murphy, co-founder of the nonprofit organization Sistering CU, speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman. Pope Francis says women have legitimate claims to seek more justice and equality in the Catholic Church, but has stopped short of endorsing more sweeping calls from his own bishops to give women decision-making roles. Francis issued a document April 2nd inspired by an October 2018 meeting of bishops on better ministering to today's young Catholics. The meeting was marked by demands for greater women's rights, and the final document called the need for women to claim decision-making positions in the Church a duty of justice. In the lengthy document, Christ is Alive, Francis endorses no such conclusion. He writes that the Church must be attentive to women's legitimate claims for equality and must better train men and women with leadership potential. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1551.